So I'm going to introduce today's lecturer. Professor Windy Dryden is one of the leading practitioners and trainers in the UK in cognitive behavioural therapy, a tradition of psychotherapy. He is best known for his work in relational emotive cognitive behavioural therapy, or RETBT. His current interest in single session and very brief interventions within therapy and a coaching concept. His goal is to disseminate SST and OAAT with the hope that this might help provide help at the point of need within the NHS. It's a form of IAPT, where the I stands for immediate. He's a Emeritus Professor of Psychotherapy at Goldsmiths University of London, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Windy Dryden. Welcome, Windy. Windy is going to present an overview of his theory and do a lecture for us as well. There's going to be a brief interlude between the lecture and the live session to give everybody a chance just to have a drink and just take stock, and then we'll go into the live session. So without further ado, Windy, it's over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate people's time on a Sunday afternoon, at least where I am in London today. So today I will give you an overview of single session therapy, and then I will do a demonstration. Let me first state that I'm, by talking about single session therapy, I'm not in any way casting aspersions about any other way of delivering counselling services, nor am I suggesting that the way I practice single session therapy is the way of practicing single session therapy, because that's not the case. That would be against the spirit of single session therapy, as a matter of fact. So with those in mind, let me just kind of go over the aims and objectives of what I'll be doing today. My main aim is to introduce some of the main ideas that inform single session therapy. And I'm a firm believer of the power of live demonstrations, not only for the client, him or herself, but also as an aid to learning. I think if you can't experience it, that it's not as powerful than if you can experience it. So my objectives at the end of the session for you is that you hopefully will become familiar with the idea that single session therapy is best seen as a mindset and a way of delivering services. That's the kind of two main points I want to stress in my presentation. And also that you'll be able to describe some of its main practical components. So let me start off by what is single session therapy. Now, OAAT stands for one at a time therapy or counseling. And that is quite often it seen as a synonymous term with single session therapy, but perhaps less dramatic, less powerful. I see single session therapy and one at a time therapy as an intentional endeavor. And that is, both the client and the therapist start out with the intention of helping the client in one session, knowing that more help is available, so that it's not good practice if a client comes to see you or a service expecting to see somebody in an ongoing way, and then being told that they're just going to have one session. That's not good practice. It is, I see single session therapy as an ethical procedure where the both parties agree to meet once, knowing that more help is available. Now, there are purists that say that single session therapy is just that. It's one session of therapy with no preparation, no follow-up, no opportunity of seeing other people, having more help. And there are times when that happens. So, for example, in the demonstration I shall be doing, that Colette and I have agreed to meet for today, with the intention of me helping her with whatever issue she's choosing to bring, which I don't know anything about at the moment. But she also knows, and I know, that will be it. There will not be an opportunity for us to continue our counselling on this issue or in any other issue. So the other thing I want to stress here is that after the session is ends, that the client is encouraged to reflect on what they've learned in the session, to digest this learning, to take action and let time pass before deciding whether or not to make another appointment. So hopefully that's really the emphasis is on really reflect, digest, act, let time pass, and then make a decision whether you want further help or not, and then make another appointment. So single session and one at a time counseling is a mindset and a mode of service delivery. It's not a specific approach to counseling or technique in the same way as somebody might say, you know, I'm a person-centered therapist, I'm a CBT therapist or whatever. It's not an orientation to the work. It's either a mindset. It has a number of attitudes that you're encouraged to embrace, and it is a way of delivering services. I think in a way that single session therapy as a mode of service delivery sits best amongst other forms of service delivery within an agency. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Stems on the belief that a brief encounter between two people can be therapeutic, that we've all probably had experience of being helped by somebody else in a short period of time. I know I have. My own experience is kind of goes back to listening to a radio in the late 1960s, a man called Michael Benteen, who said during that lecture, because he had a stammer and I have a stammer to some degree still, that he learned that the best way of getting over his anxiety was to develop the attitude and practice the attitude of, if I stammer, I stammer too bad. And that struck me at the time. I resolved to take that, to actually run with it, to practice it and to put it into practice. And that helped me enormously. Now, that was a minute of an hour's radio session. So I think that kind of underscores the point that we can derive great help from our brief encounters with people, even virtual ones like with Michael Benteen. The other point is that therapy length is expandable. If you suggest that something will take 12 sessions, then it could take 12 sessions. If you suggest it will take six, it could take six. So therapy length is expandable. And the idea is that if you really set up the session with the client sharing a similar mindset, that something meaningful can come out of this, then it often does within a session. So those are the ideas that kind of inform single session and one at a time counseling. I often think that single session therapy is a bit like a plant and that it needs certain ingredients in which to thrive and grow. And so here, I think, are the favorable conditions that underpin the work. That help is provided quickly in response to help being sought. Now, I feel quite strongly about this. I think very few of us have come in to the counseling profession with the idea where we say, I really want to help people, but only when they've been on a waiting list for 12 weeks. I don't think that we actually want that to happen. We actually do want to help people at the point of their need. And don't forget, when somebody decides to seek help, it's not a sort of a in the moment thing. They haven't gone from not thinking about it to thinking about it and then picking up the phone or actually going online. Normally, they've been grappling with this issue on their own. They may have sought help from friends and relatives. They may have decided to kind of go help and then kind of backed off. And so when they are actually coming forward for help, they are actually in a greater stage of readiness for change. And if we somehow set up our services that we don't start working with them for a period of time, that we're not actually capitalizing on or actually capturing the moment where they're ready to change. The favorable conditions as well is both therapist and client hold realistic expectations about single session therapy. And these are that something meaningful can happen. I'm not saying it's a guarantee, but something meaningful can happen when two people come together. That we're not going to necessarily bring about rapid personality change, but we're not going in there saying, well, it's one session. What can we do in one session? One of my colleagues is writing a book, and I was reading this book, and he said in his book that the purpose of the first session is so that the client comes back for a second session. And that might be fine in ongoing work, but it certainly wouldn't work within a single session framework. So that would not be a good example of a single session mindset. As I said before, it's very important that the client understands what's on offer and gives informed consent. So it is like any other form of counseling delivery, an ethical endeavor where the client is informed, understands, and consents to going forward based on what they understand is going to happen. Another favorable condition is time between help seeking and appointment is used well. When I've done workshops and I've asked people what happens when somebody contacts an agency for an appointment and they're given an appointment, you know, what happens in that interim period? Because from a single session therapy point of view, that is time that needs to be used well. Now, quite often it isn't, and therefore we want to see if we can capitalize on that by helping them to prepare for the session, to really get into the frame of mind of actually kind of being ready to go when they actually come for the appointment. Finally, organizational administrative support is provided, and so it's very easy to kill any new endeavor if you withdraw organizational and administrative support from it. So my advice is, if you want to set up a single session therapy clinic, if you like, within your agency, make sure that the people who work in the agency and the admin people who support it are on board, because otherwise it's going to be like walking up a hill in treacle. Now, let me very quickly go over what I see as the unfavorable conditions. You put single session therapy in this type of soil with this kind of light, this kind of water, it's going to wither and die. And so the ingredients here that aren't favorable conditions, if you like, there's a long gap between help being sought and help being provided. It doesn't make sense to have a single session therapy mode of service delivery, which you have to wait for 3 months or 2 months or whatever. Help is provided after certain conditions have been met. That is a full assessment, case formulation, or case history. Now, please don't misquote me. I'm not against these activities per se. All I'm saying is that they're not conditions that help single session therapy thrive. I'm not saying that I'm against these activities per se. Okay, just want to make that clear. Time between initial contact and help being provided is not used or not used well, which unfortunately is the norm. Blocks of sessions are offered. Now, blocks of sessions, again, not against blocks of sessions, particularly if there is a good clinical reason for it. I'm kind of against the offering of a block of sessions as a way of actually offering everybody a block. Quite often when I've asked people what number of sessions occur in a block. The most frequently occurring number of sessions is six for some reason. I don't understand that. I ask for why, and they probably say, well, it's always been this way. Why not five? Why not seven? It's not clear. But blocks of sessions as a rollout to everybody will lead to waiting lists. And if you have greater waiting lists, then you are extending the time between help at the point of help sought and help given, which you actually want to avoid within the single session framework. And there's a lack of organizational and administrative support. Now, I now want to go over some of the three major foundations of single session therapy. Before I show you the slide, I'm going to ask you a question. And that is, what do you think across the world in a public and charitable or non-profit agencies? I'm not talking about private practice now, okay? Anything apart from private practice. What do you think is the modal number of sessions that clients have? Now, mode is the most frequently occurring number. So please write down somewhere, you can put it in the chat box if you like, what you think universally is the most frequently occurring number of sessions that clients have internationally. I'm just going to pause there when you might write something. I'm just going to see, I can actually see if you're writing something. Okay, so there's fours and sixes and 12s and, well, you're okay, good one. Thank you very much for engaging with me on this. So I'm going to stop that, because otherwise I'm going to get to feel rather dizzy if I can stop that. Okay, so here is the answer, folks. The answer is, drum roll, one, followed by two, followed by three. Okay, so this is a typical graph that you'll get. This actually comes from Australia. There are vast amounts of data here, by the way, over a three-year period. You'll see that about between 40 and 45% of clients have one session, and it goes down to two, three. There's a slight pickup at the end, because beyond 20, all the data are merged together. So the most frequent number of sessions clients have internationally is one, followed by two, followed by three. And when I show people this graph, people say, well, that's because either the counseling they've been offered is rubbish, and they go away dissatisfied with it, they've dropped out, and that's a bad thing. So you know, that's the situation. Well, actually, that's not the case. When we have a look at the data again, we find that the following happens: that between 70 to 80% of those who have a single session are satisfied with that session given current circumstances. That, of course, means that 20 to 30% aren't, so we don't want to neglect that. But it's not the case that if somebody doesn't turn up for a single session, beyond the single session, that they are unhappy, and far from it. And the third foundation is that therapists are poor at predicting who will attend for only one session and who will attend for more. So, you know, we can spend a lot of time trying to, you know, hear about somebody who's come in and been assessed and try to find out what is the best therapy for them, and spend a lot of time trying to work that one out, and they don't turn up again. So that's going to be a problem. So the help provided at the point of need, which is, I think, sort of really the core idea in single session therapy, is based itself on a number of ideas. And that is, it's better to respond to client need by providing some help straight away rather than by waiting to provide the best possible help. Only today over Twitter, I was having a discussion with some people who were quite critical of EAPs, saying that, you know, you're given, let's say, six sessions again, an EAP practitioner and what happens if the client wants to kind of go on. And some people say, well, I don't want to work in that way because I want to give everybody who comes into me as much counseling as they need. And you know, I can understand that, but unfortunately the world is not structured around the provision of so much, you know, counseling resources being available. So we do have to make decisions. And one of the decisions that underpins single session therapy, it's better to respond to client need by providing some help straight away than rather than by waiting to provide the best possible help. Providing immediate help is more important than carrying out an assessment or a case formulation, and therapy can be initiated in the absence of a case history. Sometimes I ask people in a single session, what do you think I need to know about you? This is essential for me to be able to help you today, rather than me carrying out any sort of case history, which is you know, going to be kind of problematic in terms of the time that I'll have available. So it also says people have the resources to make use of help provided at the point of need. So it has quite an optimistic viewpoint about what human beings are capable of. It's also based on the idea that sooner is better. Often, you know, we argue that more is better, but here sooner is better. And the best way to see if a client will respond well to therapy is by offering them therapy to see how well they respond. People say to me, you know, how do I know that a client is going to benefit from single session therapy? And my answer is, you don't. Why not offer them a single session and see how they respond? Now, another group of people say, well, what about risk? And my response is, you do exactly the same in a single session with risk as you do in any other counseling mode of delivery. Apart from one thing, you get to find out about risk earlier than you would if actually people are actually waiting for help. So appropriate therapy length is best determined by the client. You know, we may have six sessions in our mind, and in cognitive behavior therapy, we have packages and protocols of 10 sessions of this, 12 sessions of this, and that's fine. I'm not looking against that. I'm not against that. But clients will actually say, well, actually, thanks. I'm done. Thank you very much. I don't need to come back. Clients will determine what is appropriate length for them. And when a person doesn't return, as I kind of indicated before, this may indicate this. There's a very good chance that it indicates the person is satisfied with what they achieved, although it may be the case that some were dissatisfied with the help provided. Now, let me have a look at what the goals of single session therapy are. And I think they are as follows: to help the client to get unstuck, because often clients are stuck. They keep doing the same things over and over again. They unwittingly maintain their problems. And if you can help, them to kind of help get unstuck. And also, secondly, to take a few steps forward, that may well actually help them without them seeking further help. Another goal is to help them address a specific concern, or to give them an opportunity to talk for an hour and explore a concern. This is not all about focus, although it often is. It can be an opportunity to stand back and reflect, and you as a counselor would actually be able to help them to do that in a single session. Another goal is to help the client to see that they do have the wherewithal to achieve their goals. To work with them to select a solution to help them to deal with the problem so that they can work towards their goal. And if possible, to actually gain experience of the solution through two-chair dialogue or role play or imagery work or things like that. And then to help the client to develop a broad action plan and maybe encourage them, you know, to actually kick off that action plan in a specific way. I think probably one of the most frequently asked questions that I have is that who is suitable for single session therapy? And now I asked myself that question when I first got into this field about 6 or 7 years ago. And that is, what I did was I developed a long list of indications and contraindications. And then it occurred to me what I was doing. And I was coming up with a single session, which I'd need to carry out with the client in order to find out if they were suitable for a single session, which is A, bit of a nonsense, and two, not a good use of time. And if hopefully you've grasped the idea that in single session therapy, time is important to use, and time spent assessment, doing assessments or suitability assessments or things like that, not good use of therapy time. And in single session therapy, you offer therapy from moment one. In walk-in clinics, which we don't really have a great tradition of in Britain, they have them more in Australia, Canada, and America. People walk in. They don't sort of do their own suitability criteria. They're not assessed in any way. They walk in for a session of therapy, and if they're not appropriate, the person will actually guide them to where they are appropriate. But most of them, because they understand the kind of problems through dissemination, which I won't have time to talk about today, it's important to be able to disseminate to the population about what you are offering. In walk-in therapy, there's no suitability criteria. You can structure your service in terms of client choice. As I said before, this mode of service delivery serves best when sitting alongside others. Clients will say, aha, now they have this. Oh, I think a single session would actually help me. And so that the client will be able to kind of choose and, you know, see what happens. Let's see. It's a sort of open-minded let's see. The final approach is what's called the embedded approach. And this is done by a family therapy center in Australia called the Bouverie Center. What they do is this. Everybody who comes to the agency has a single session. Now, they know from their statistics over the years that between 45 and 50%, that will be sufficient for them at that time, given their circumstances. The rest of the 50%, some will need another single session, some will need some ongoing help, some will need some specialized help. But that is not based on the idea of assessment before therapy. That is comes up through the offering of a session of therapy, which helps the almost half of the people who go to the Bouverie Center. Now, let me talk a little bit about what is good practice here. And I'm going to put that within the context of the single session, one at a time therapy mindset, because I think that they're kind of linked. And the first one is to celebrate the power of now. All you know when you're with a client is that you're with a client. You don't know whether they're coming back or not. You can make predictions. You may be right some of the time. You may be wrong some of the time. And so the question is, since I am with the person now, how do I best want to use the time? Do I want the time that I have with them now doing an assessment of all their problems, doing a case formulation? Do I want to get a case history? Or do I want to offer them an hour of therapy focused on their most pressing concern and needs? So the single session mindset is actually saying the latter. Because we only know that the person is with us now, let's capture the moment, let's seize the day, other phrases like that, and let's offer the person therapy focused on what they want, and having created the realistic expectations that if we both work together, something meaningful can come from this. It is client-centered, not in the sense that client-centered therapy or person-centered therapy. It's centered on what the client most wants to get from the therapy, not what the therapist think they need. And so often when I'm asked the question, what about clients with this disorder or this problem? And all these are based on therapist constructions. And my answer is based on the client's wants. And it is, well, yes, they may have this disorder or this problem or this diagnosis, but what do they want from this session? You see, it's focused on what the client wants. People often say, well, how can you I can't do this because the therapeutic alliance or the therapeutic relationship needs time to develop. And again, I'm not knocking the work of my good friend. I think he actually gave a CPD event a while ago on relational depth. Mick Cooper does some fine work there. I'm not against that. But what I'm saying is not all clients want that kind of relational depth with their therapist. And some just want to be helped quickly. And so I have a concept which I call relational promptness, that being able to develop an alliance quickly through the work, through your enthusiasm to help people quickly and focused on what they want to get from the session. This enables you to actually engage the client quest quite quickly. One of my most favorite questions in this field is, how can I best help you today? And that, if people say, I don't know, I say, well, I can help you to focus on a problem and help you to develop a solution to that problem. I can help you to explore matters if you are confused and you'd like an opportunity to kind of reflect with somebody else helping you to understand what's going on for you. So, the client is actually, if you practice X therapeutic approach, then there's always a danger that the client is going to come in and going to get that therapeutic approach. Now, yeah, as you'll see, my own practice is informed by my own ideas. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to tailor what I can can offer based on what the client will think will help them most, on that occasion. Develop an end of session goal. Most counselors, not all, but most counselors will ask the question of clients, what would you like to achieve from counseling? And again, great question, not knocking that if the counseling is more ongoing. But for single session therapy, since, the end of the session is the end of the therapy quite often, a better question would be to ask the question what they would like to achieve at the end of the session. Good practice is to focus, to agree a focus and to keep on track with that focus during the session. Good pacing. People often come to this work thinking, oh my God, I've got 50 minutes. Another frequently asked question is, how long is a session in single session therapy? And it depends. In family therapy, it can be up to an hour and a half. My own practice, I say to people that we have up to 50 minutes together. Now, that's the up to is important because quite often I'm done earlier helping the person to achieve what they want. And so if I've achieved that after 40 minutes and I've promised 50, then there's a risk of undermining, unraveling what I've done by spending another 10 minutes, I don't know, talking about another problem, talking about the weather. I don't know what we talk about then. But keeping on track is important. Good pacing is important. You have time. If your attitude towards time is, we have plenty of time here to get the job done, as opposed to, I've only got 50 minutes, oh my God, then you're going to be anxious, you're going to rush, they're going to be rushed, you're going to not get anything from it. Clarity in all ways, being clear about what's on offer, can the person have extra help, how can they access it. At the beginning, you go over that. At the end of that, you remind them of that. Clarity of communications, sometimes helping the client to stand back and to kind of reflect on, to see if they've understood what you've been talking about. Making an emotional impact, which is halfway between having a theoretical session and then being flooded with so much affect they can't think, but doing this work within something of an emotional sort of climate is important. Identify utilizing client strengths is important because people are going to bring strengths. And quite often when you kind of help them to reconnect with those strengths, that in itself can be quite therapeutic. Environmental resources, people have people on their team. Who's on team Windy? I've got somebody who can help me, you know, think through things. Somebody might want to give me a kick up the backside if I need it. And so we all have different people that we can turn to. Only we can do it, but we don't have to do it alone. Identifying and utilizing previous attempts to deal with the problem, capitalizing what's been helpful, casting aside which hasn't been helpful, negotiating a solution, as you see here, that's a halfway between the problem and the goal is a solution, helping people to actually develop that, which is comes from what's been helpful before, their strengths, some other ideas that you might, as a therapist, based on your orientation, kind of put to them, then rehearsing the solution, if possible, in the session, helping the client to go away with one thing that's meaningful rather than being overloaded with so much help that they actually end up taking away nothing. And that's a real danger. If you take an ongoing counseling mindset into a single session context, you think, oh my God, you know, I've got to help them to take away as much as possible. Well, you know, they'll drop everything and they'll go away with nothing is the real danger. Helping them to develop an action plan, how they can put into practice the solution that you've worked, you know, with them if possible. And having them summarize what they've got from the session at the end rather than you summarizing is important. To tie up the loose ends, clarify next steps, reminding them how they might access further help if necessary, going over the reflect, digest, take action, let time pass, and then make a decision type of routine at this point, and arranging a follow-up, just to do a follow-up evaluation. Although the purists would say then that's not part of the single session. I think in this climate, evaluation is important. So hopefully I've actually given you an opportunity to see a taster of what single session and one at a time therapy involves. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, Colette, thank you for volunteering. Perhaps you can just let me know what your understanding is concerning the purpose of this session.
Of course. So my understanding is for me to bring a live and pressing issue, something that I want to address at this moment in time, something that that for the purposes of demonstration is something I'm comfortable to share with the audience we have present, which I am very much so. And it is a presentation that has been with me throughout all of my life and has always created difficulty for me, and a resolution of it would be really, really useful.
Okay, well, that's perhaps you'd like to tell me what the issue is to start with.
Okay, so from my understanding, it is, a fairly common presentation. It's that of procrastination, but not a matter of procrastination of just not doing anything and just on the couch and watching TV or not doing anything at all. It's more a matter of not attending to important matters first. So I will put off that what is really, really important in favor for that what is urgent. So the important things always get put to the side or put off again and again and again to the point.
Let me clarify, Colette. You said that you put off things that are important in favor of those which are urgent.
That's correct. Yes. So how can I, let's say, for example, in work, I have a piece of work that is important to get done because it is relating to a deadline, an outcome that is critical to the progression of a project, for example, but I would put that off in favor for answering maybe low-level emails or something that really is not
right.
Important.
So let me clarify this, that latter situation. It's not that it is urgent. It is something that you know at the time is lower level of importance.
That's correct. Yes.
So have you got something that you are procrastinating on right now that we could really focus on, so that if I could really help you with that and
maybe roll out some general principles going forward that you might think, you know, I'm pleased that I volunteered today?
Yes. So let me have a think. I'm currently working on a project, excuse me, that involves me having to write up an email I need to send out to participants. Sorry, I just want to take a sip of water. Frog seemed to have crawled into my throat.
I will join you in that one.
Excuse me. So I need to write up a draft, an email that would form the basis of reaching out to participants to help within this project. So it is an important step to roll out or to progress a project I'm currently working on. And I have had this task in my diary, to-do list, however I use, whatever I use to sort of manage my work. And I've had this task for probably going on a couple of weeks. However, I find myself putting the task off and in favor of answering emails of people that needs maybe support with their accounts, or the accountant that wants to know about something that is not due for months to come, and putting off that important task of sitting for maybe half an hour to write up the email that would then be able to move the project further.
But okay, so if I was to ask you, Colette, to nominate a specific time in the very near future when you are willing to commit to sitting down with the intention of doing that task, what would be the date and time that you would agree with yourself to do that?
This is a very interesting one, because I can already feel panic rising in me, because I'm going, I can't do it for the rest of today because it's Sunday and I'm working till late. Can't do it tomorrow because I've already got something planned in. And then tomorrow afternoon, I will have to do the work that is urgent. And so it goes. So currently,
are those reasons good reasons, or are they rationalizations, Colette?
I am unsure. I think for me, they feel like very good reasons and rationalizations. If I think of what my workload and demand is, I would know.
I mean, a rationalization, but by rationalization, I mean an excuse.
An excuse. No, I think they're good reasons. But yes. They sound like they probably are more excuses than they are rationalizations. So, if I think about it, I would probably be able to do it tomorrow around 10 o'clock.
Okay. So let's suppose that you agree with yourself that you will do it not around 10 o'clock, because that gives you, you know, I'm talking about at 10 o'clock. Yes. Would you at least, you know, commit to sitting down and at 10 o'clock with the intention of doing that task?
Yes, as I am here, every intention.
Okay, now, fine. Now, with that commitment, okay, how would you stop yourself from actually keeping that commitment to yourself?
So how would I stop? So what would be the reason for me not doing it? I would get caught up with the urgent, and when 10 o'clock comes,
you get caught up.
I will get caught up in the urgent tasks. So
now, again, you see, I'm a bit confused here, Colette, and maybe you can, because some of the time you call them urgent, mm-hmm. and some of the time you call them low level.
Yes,
and I'm a little confused about okay. that.
Okay, so let's have a think of how I can explain that. So some of them are urgent.
Okay, so here we are at 10 o'clock, okay, and you've committed, you know, to write this email, right, because it is important, right? Now, what is something that you think, oh, wait a minute, that is urgent, so that has greater kind of precedence to that important task that I've made a commitment? Give me an example of what might, you know, suddenly be urgent in your mind.
A customer support query.
Okay. So a customer support query might say what?
Might say, I am unable to access my account.
Okay. Now, so then you have a choice at that time, right?
Yes.
You have a choice to actually fulfill your commitment to yourself and do the important task, or you have a choice to stop that for yourself and actually do help that other person with their query. Mm-hmm. Okay. What would you do?
My behavior so far has been to tend to the urgent task.
You call it urgent, and I just wonder whether it is, because if you say to that person, you know, I'll get back to you in 2 hours. If you give them a specific time frame, because you've got things that you've got to do. Mm. I mean, are they going to go crazy or mad or?
Probably not.
No. Okay.
Probably not.
So it's almost as if, are you saying because it comes from somebody else, it's urgent?
There is definitely that feeling, that expectation of, I have to attend to this immediately.
Because it comes from another person?
Yes.
So it sounds like, and you correct me if I'm wrong, because I may well be wrong, the choice is, right, do I put the other person first, or do I put me, Colette, first?
Yes, that is very much correct. That is very correct.
Okay, so if you decide, right, to put you first over the other person, how will you feel if you made that decision?
At the time, it's very uncomfortable. And while I'm then doing task of importance, I will constantly be thinking, I should be doing something else. I should be attending to the urgent task.
Now, again, because we're just talking about the is it always when somebody else is, you know, is asking you to do something for themselves? Is that the case? Because I don't want to get this wrong.
Definitely. There is a very, very strong drive when it is
somebody else. It sounds like, Colette, that once, even if you were to choose to put yourself first, there's still some sort of dialogue going, but I should be helping them first. I should be kind of basically, I should be putting them before me.
Yes.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay. Are you happy with that?
Most of the time, I guess it's fine. But when it becomes really difficult is when my important work suffers as a result of it.
Right. So you don't mind putting other people before you, before yourself, Colette, but you recognize that, you know, but not when you suffer.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So what would you like to change on this particular specific issue that we'd like to talk about? What would it be healthy for you to do for you?
It would be healthy for me to be able to stick to commitments and tasks and that I put for myself, that I know is important, that and I know that needs my attention. But more than that would be that I don't feel pulled.
I don't feel
pulled that I need to be somewhere else, because I find whenever I am in that situation of working on that what is important, there's almost always this feeling of I need to be doing something else.
But again, I just want to clarify, is the I need to be doing something else, I need to be helping someone else? Because the example that you've given is it's a choice between, you know, whether you put you first or somebody else first.
Yes. And I'm thinking it might be around the expectation, wanting to meet the expectation that I perceive the other person may have.
And the expectation would be what, if you were to put it into words?
For my immediate attention or my immediate resolve.
Right. So it's about them saying to you, Colette, kind of, we need help now.
Mm.
Right.
That's how.
And ideally, you'd like to say, well, okay, wait a minute. I'll get back to you in 2 hours, which is basically you saying, I'm going to put myself first for 2 hours, and then that I'm going to deal with you.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if you're operating, you correct me if I'm wrong, on the idea that when somebody wants me immediately, I have to drop everything and help them.
That's very correct, yes.
Yeah. And if I don't, what?
I guess it's that I may disappoint them.
And if they're disappointed, what?
That feels like that the approval element that I don't get the approval or I don't get the acceptance or that somehow I have failed them or let them down.
Yeah, you may not, right? Mm. But you may get their respect. Mm. Because, you know, they'll say, oh, well, wait a minute. She has said that she's going to come back to me and she's given me a time. And so, yeah, okay, she's got other things to do. Right. So you may not get their approval, but you might get their respect. What's more important to you?
That's an interesting one. Approval is very important to me. It really is very important.
Because if I'm not approved by this person, if I say no to them, in terms of me not meeting their immediate needs, and they might disapprove of me, that means what to me?
At some level, at a very deep level, that feels like I am not good enough. I'm not
good enough for whom?
For them.
Yeah, but you might not be good enough for them. Now, I want to ask you a question, Colette, a very important question. Can you be good enough for you when you're not good enough for them, meaning this person who may or may not, you know, dislike you or lack or not approve of you? Can you be good enough for you when you're not good enough for them or not?
No, I know, and I know that on a intellectual level, I know that I have to look after me first so that I'm able to serve others.
Yes. But I'm not talking about that necessarily. I'm not talking about self-care, which is an important issue. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what you're talking about, which is, can you really be good enough for you in your mind? Can you hold on to, if you like, you approving of you when somebody else doesn't approve of you?
I really struggle with that.
Okay, what's the struggle?
That if the struggle around that is am I okay with me, even if they are not okay with me?
Right. So it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a choice, isn't it? Because you could say, yes, I am okay with me, even if I'm not okay with them. Or I'm not okay with me if I'm not okay with them.
Mm.
It's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what choice do you want to make, Colette?
I need to be okay with me, regardless of anyone, if anyone else is okay with me.
Fine. Now, if that's your choice, right, have a guess what it would take to really believe it.
I just have to believe it.
No.
Okay.
Be nice. That would be great. I mean, that would be magic. I mean, boom, she believes it. You know. I don't think it's going to happen that way. Have you ever had the experience of, you know, kind of not believing something, but then kind of recognizing that if you acted in a different way, you could come to believe it?
Yes.
And you acted in that way and you kind of believed it?
Yes.
Have you ever had that experience?
Yes, I have.
Yeah? Just briefly, what was it?
I started running some years ago after always believing I'm not able to ever be physically active and fit.
Right.
And then started running and then saw that if I acted and continued with my running, I am able to become fit and run, essentially.
If you waited to believe it first before you ran, what would have happened?
I wouldn't have.
Right. So you've had the experience of what I'm talking about. Mm. If you want to make that choice of, in a sense, being good enough for you, even if you may not be good enough for them, we don't know, actually. Mm. In fact, you never find out because you never find out. And so, you know, if you want to kind of practice this, you need to be disapproved of, in order to get the practice of approving of you in the face of being disapproved of. But in order to do that, Colette, what do you think you need to do on Monday morning?
I have to act differently.
Right. Even though the pull will still be there. Just because the pull is there, that's the pull is really saying, hello, this is your old friend. I can only approve of myself if I'm approved of. Come over here. You could go there. That's easy. But to stick there and say, no, wait a minute. No, you know, this is going to be difficult, but I'm going to work on putting me first, approving me, even if I'm disapproved of. Hmm. Now, also, that will give you an opportunity to find out what the other person will say. If yes. you don't, because you never find out.
Yep.
You're trapped in this loop.
Yes, I certainly am.
So would you like to summarize where we've got to so far, Colette?
Definitely, yes. So for me, I brought a situation that has been plaguing me for many a year, where I would pay attention to urgent and sometimes low-level tasks in favor of the important work where I need to put myself first. And through explaining the situation and what goes on for me and the feelings that I feel, I have been able to get down to a level where I'm able to identify a feeling of needing approval from others. And being able to recognize that I need to be able to approve of myself regardless if others approve of me or not. And then to put into action the decision to put my own priorities before others, and through the process learn what it takes to approve for myself and what it will feel like having this disapproval of others and still be okay to approve of myself.
Yeah. Right. So let me kind of take you through that solution and kind of rehearse it from Monday morning. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Monday comes at 10 o'clock. And you have this commitment with yourself. You say, okay, I'm going to show up at 10 o'clock because, you know, I really want to help myself. And incidentally, just want to say one thing. You're not doing it for me, right?
Yes.
I will survive whether you do this or not. Doing it for you. Okay. Okay. Because I don't want you to do it for, you know, to get my approval. Right. Okay. So Monday comes, 10 o'clock, and you sit down and you've got this thing that, you know, that you've been kind of is important for you to do. And then something comes in that somebody wants you to do something for them. And imagine even though it's uncomfortable because you're very drawn to doing it. And then you say, no, this is my point of change. I'm going to tell them, I'm going to give them a time when I'm going to do it. It's a time after I've done this. So you tell them, right? And if they kind of, you know, say, oh, well, can't you do it any quicker? You say, well, that's the quickest I can do it. I want to be clear with you when I can do it. And then you go back and you start the work, even though there's still a part of you that's uncomfortable with all that and wants to go back and make it right, but you're sticking with it, just as you did with the run.
Yes.
Okay. Now, is that a realistic thing for you to rehearse before doing it and then doing it that way?
Definitely.
Yeah?
Very, very implementable, yes.
Okay. Will you choose to implement it?
I will.
Who for?
For me.
I'm sorry. The audio's going. What was that?
For me.
Look, I'm an old man. I can't hear. What?
I will be doing it for me, Wendy. Definitely.
Good. Excellent. Okay. So is this a good place to stop?
A good place to stop, was it? Yes. I think it feels. It feels like a good place to stop. I feel that I have got some resolution and a new perspective on why I will be favoring those, and I will be putting steps in place to challenge and push through the discomfort in order to focus on the important work I need to do.
Okay, good. Well, I look forward to not hearing about it because I'm not going to hear about it.
Thank you very much. Okay. That really felt like a really helpful session.
Okay, good.